I'm going to be reading Genesis chapter 38. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go in to your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went in to his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up." For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hirah, the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He answered, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "If you give me a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, "Where is the cult prostitute who was at Enaim at the roadside?" And they said, "No cult prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Also, the men of the place said, "No cult prostitute has been here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant." And she said, "Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff." Then Judah identified them and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah," and he did not know her again. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterwards, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah.
Thank you, Sarah, very much indeed for reading for us. May I add my welcome, especially if you're here for the first time visiting us, a warm welcome to you and to St. Helens. A much-loved elderly relative of mine used to love telling long stories. Her stories were almost all about the family, old relatives and past events, who was related to who and so on. And at their simplest, they were very complex. She had very severe arthritis. And at about 6 o'clock in the evening, she would take her medication to ease the pain. And the medication consisted of half a tumbler of brandy, beyond which point the lengthy family stories rambled, were interspersed with long, winding and seemingly unconnected digressions. I was telling one of the staff about this earlier today, one of the most naughty members of staff, whose first name is Paul, and he said, ah, William, I see where you get it from. Now, as a teenager, I have to confess that in spite of my love for my elderly relative, the eye would glaze over and the mind would turn to the next rugby game or party. But unfortunately, she had the most extraordinary ability to be able to spot when your mind had wandered. And at just the point when you thought she would never end, she would fix you with a piercing stare and ask you one of those questions that removes the middle stump completely. Now, it looks at first glance as if this account of Judah's incest and his extraordinary activities is just a digression. If you were with us last week, you'll know that we've started the account of Joseph's life. The BBC, I don't think, deliberately timed their new series on Saturday evenings to coincide with ours, but we are running in parallel with You Must Be Dreaming, or whatever it is, which I have absolutely no interest in at all, though have watched repeatedly since it started. And last week, having begun the series, we left Joseph being led away in captivity by a passing band of Midianite traders who were going to sell him into slavery in Egypt. And far from singing poor, poor Joseph, Joseph's brothers were the ones who actually sold him into slavery, and they were shedding crocodile tears alongside their father as they pretended to comfort him in his grief. Now, I don't know about you, but I want to know what's happening to Joseph. Our narrator seems to have missed the point. I mean, this is meant to be about Joseph. And yet he lingers for one long chapter. I must say, if it was being interspersed into one of my grandmother's stories, I would have been absolutely riveted by it, wouldn't you? Judah and his goings on. But what on earth's it got to do with the plot? Well, actually, it's got an enormous amount to do with the plot. And by missing chapter 37, verse 2, we would be in danger of missing why chapter 38 is so significant. So just flick back to 37 verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. You see, this story is really about Jacob. Joseph has a huge amount to do with it, but it's not primarily about, it's really about God, actually. But it's about Jacob and his family and what comes from his family. And Genesis is divided like this by key markers. They didn't have chapter divisions in those days. They've been put in since. And each key marker in Genesis begins, these are the generations of, these are the generations of, these are the generations of. The first key marker comes in chapter 2, verse 4, and the next in chapter 5, verse 1, and so it goes on. And in each major section, there are just one or two big points. And the what's known as the Joseph narrative is actually all about Jacob and his family. And the book of Genesis was written and given to the people of God as they made their way from slavery in Egypt back to the promised land of Canaan. And the big key lessons in each of these major sections were intended, first of all, for God's people on their journey to the promised land. And the big key lessons that we learn in each of these key big sections of Genesis, therefore, come to us as we make our journey to God's promised new creation. And the key in understanding Judah is to realize that the story that we're involved in is not just about Joseph, it's about the whole of this family chosen by God, of whom Judah is a key member. So we're going to learn key lessons about God and the kind of people with whom God deals tonight. And we're going to learn a key lesson about God and his absolute determination to keep his promise to this family. Come what may, he will keep it. We're going to see that Judah is an out-and-out creep. He is spiritually, morally, and in every way someone who we can happily despise. And yet Judah is taken by God and rescued. And we find that God deals with people like that. Moreover, we're going to see that God is determined to keep his promises to this family, in spite of the fact that it's made up with people like that. And I hope we're going to find that that moves us to a much deeper commitment to God. You know, spiritual and moral failure can be extraordinarily debilitating. We can carry the weight of spiritual and moral failure around our neck as a kind of cork in a bottle, if to mix six or seven metaphors all at once, that just prevents us from ever being wholly committed to God. And in seeing that God deals with people like Judah, I hope we're going to be able to see that it's possible, even if we're carrying the most awful secrets, as it were, around our neck, to be committed to this God. And in seeing that God keeps his promises come what may, I hope we will find ourselves determining not to be a Judah. Now, our method is going to be quite unusual for what we normally do on a Sunday night. I'm going to go right the way through the story. There'll be quite a few lessons on the way as we look at the story again of this account of Judah. And then at the end, I'm going to draw 2 points of application. These are the kind of people God deals with. And God is committed 100% to his promise. Okay, happy? So let's have a look at Judah. Now we can see straight away that Judah is a spiritual failure. Verse 1, he went down from his brothers and he turned aside to a certain Adullamite. He saw the daughter of a Canaanite. The Canaanite's name was Shua, and he took her as his wife. I don't think it's at all a surprise that Judah has left home. He has been instrumental in selling Joseph into slavery, and every day he meets with Jacob and Jacob's grief, he is reminded of his own guilt. Rather than deal with the guilt, Judah does what so many people do. He runs from it. But in running from his brothers and in turning aside to the Adullamite, and in taking a Canaanite wife, we need to realize what it is that Judah is doing in these early verses. Jacob's family, you see, are the family of God's promise. Jacob's family are kind of where the action is. These are the people that God has promised all his blessing. These are the people to whom God has promised the land. These are the people who God has said will be a blessing to the nations. These are the people whom God is going to dwell with, Jacob and his family. And in verses 1 and 2, we see Judah consciously going away from these people and lining himself up deliberately with the Adullamite and then taking for himself a Canaanite wife, rather than taking for himself a wife from among God's people. So I think it is very fair to say that Judah is walking away from God. And as he walks away from God, he walks away from the family of promise. Rather than confront his guilt, Judah flees into the arms of the idolatrous Adullamite and turns to the world. In my experience, it is almost always the way that when a person distances themselves from God, they distance themselves from God's people. It's one of the sure signs that a person is running from God, that they run from God's people. Now, you will have noticed it if you're part of a small group, or if you've got a regular band of Christian friends. When somebody is struggling with standing with God, Over and over again, you will find that they struggle with standing with God's people. In my experience, it's always the way that as we run from God's people and throw ourselves into the arms of those who are not God's people and line up with Hira the Adullamite, as it were, we find ourselves entering into a moral and spiritual freefall, which is exactly what happens to Judah. So in verses 3 to 5, they're fairly uneventful, except for verse 5. Sarah very sweetly, and I think probably rightly, gave him the name Shelah. In our family, it's caused enormous mirth that Judah might have named one of his sons Shelah. But there we go. Then in verses 6 to 11, we begin to chart the decline. The time came for Judah to choose a wife for his eldest son. He calls him Ur. He chooses the wife Tamar, who almost certainly is another Canaanite. And it seems that Judah has absolutely no concern at all for God's promise for offspring for God's people. Like Judah, his sons are a rough bunch. Ur in Hebrew, apparently, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I'm told that Ur spells evil backwards. And Ur was certainly wicked. God brings him to an early death. Following Ur's death, Onan ought to have gone about marrying Tamar and producing children for her who would be known as Ur's kids. Now, that's a little bit of a complex idea to us. It's known as levirate marriage, and performing the duty of a brother-in-law to your sister-in-law meant making sure that your dead brother-in-law had children who would bear your brother's name. Making sure your brother, rather, had children by your sister-in-law who would bear your brother's name. I explained levirate marriage to my sister-in-law once, and I've noticed ever since she's taken a very keen interest in keeping my brother very healthy and alive. He's never looked fitter. The prospect. Anyway, there we go. We don't do that, by the way. If there's somebody here from the press, if you're, you know, tomorrow morning's Times or whatever, no, that is not practice at St. Helens. Anyway, Onan wasn't in the least bit interested either in God's promise of producing a nation of offspring for Abram, Isaac and Jacob, or in having the dead Ur's children. And so he engaged in this primitive form of contraception that's described in verse 9. Now, I guess, in a way, it's understandable that following the events of his previous two sons, Jacob is somewhat timid about committing Shelah to Tamar. And therefore, Jacob sends Tamar back home to her father, promises that Tamar will be allowed to marry Shelah, and then Jacob promptly deletes Tamar from the hard drive of his memory. And it's quite clear by the time you get to verse 14 that Shelah had grown up, and Jacob had absolutely no intention of making sure that the promise of children to his family should be kept. And therefore, at this point, I think it's right to say that everything looks hopeless for the promise of God, that he would make this family into a mighty nation. Not only so, Jacob appears totally to have abandoned all interest in the great promises of God. Tamar is less dull. Quite how she manages to stomach what she does in verse 12 to 19 is hard to say, isn't it? You young marrieds don't think about it too hard. It doesn't really bear much thinking about as she dresses herself up and gives herself to her father-in-law. But she is at least deeply concerned for the offspring that Ur ought to have had. Far more concerned, in fact, than Judah. And by the end of the story, Judah says, "She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her my son." She's quite a woman, isn't she, Tamar? Quick-wicked, witted, canny, determined. She spins her web. She bides her time. She baits her trap. She knows her prey. And then, well, she doesn't pounce. He pounces. Sheep shearing time was the equivalent of kind of end exam party time. It was the celebratory party you might have after completing a deal, or the office Christmas party. Every pagan in Canaan had a few sherbets too many at sheep shearing time. And furthermore, and this is the very important point, in idolatrous Hera's neck of the woods, the idols whom the people worshipped were said to guarantee the fertility of your crops and your animals if you could stimulate them to be fertile. And as with all pagan, non-Christian religion, it becomes utterly gross eventually. And the way you stimulated your idols to be fertile was to sleep with the cult prostitute. And your sexual activity with the cult prostitute on earth was said to stimulate the idol in heaven to fertility. Now, it's very interesting, isn't it, that in verse 16 you can see Judah turned aside for a second time. It's exactly the same word as you get in verse 1. So that just as Judah turned aside from his brothers to Hira the Adullamite in the first place, verse 1, by verse 16 you can see how far he's sunk as he turns aside to what he thinks is a cult prostitute. He's up to his neck in pagan idolatry. He has fled from God. He has fled from God's people. He has been bewitched by the world. He is worshipping the pagan way, and without realizing it, he is committing incest to boot. It's fair to say, isn't it, that his life is a complete and utter shambles? And yet, extraordinarily, his determination is there to protect his reputation. It's funny, isn't it, how when a person is so immersed in wickedness, they can still be determined to keep up a public face of decency. So when Hira can't find the prostitute with whom Judah has slept, of course, because Tamar's now taken off her clothes, prostitution disguise, when Hira can't find the prostitute with whom Judah has slept, he comes out with verse 23. Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. Literally, we shall be ashamed, or shamed in front of the pagans. We shall be mocked. Which again is so much the way, you know, the world, as always, longs to lure God's people into the kind of morass of moral degradation. And then when God's people are lured into it, oh, they rejoice and mock and laugh. We see it over and over again. Finally, and this really is the pits, Judah, who has slept with the prostitute, finds out that Tamar, his daughter-in-law, is pregnant and has obviously been immoral, and he engages in an act of such rank hypocrisy as to be utterly contemptible. Judah, the man who sleeps with prostitutes, says verse 24 and 25. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Again, it is typical, actually, isn't it, of humanity that we can turn a blind eye to our own sinful activity whilst being quite prepared to demand full judgment on somebody else who has stumbled in just the same way. Well, Tamar has been extraordinarily clever, and she uncovers Judah. And in a sense, this incident is all about the uncovering of Judah's guilt. A brilliant foil to chapter 37, where Judah is guilty and disguises his guilt. And in a sense, that's going to be one of the big themes of the next few chapters. Verse 25, you see, should be familiar to us, the language. Let me read it. And if you were here last week, you'll recognize the language. As Tamar was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify who these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. And then Judah identified them and said. Now, do you remember from last week what the brothers did with Joseph's multicolored, that famous multicolored coat? Turn, just look back to verse 32 of chapter 37. You don't need to turn the page back. It's just across the column there. Chapter 37, verse 22. This we have found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not. And he identified it and said. Just as Judah and his brothers sought to conceal their guilt through the deception of Joseph and his robe that they sent back to Jacob, so Judah's guilt is exposed through the deception of Tamar and the identifying of Judah's personal belongings. Judah has been identified, his cover is blown, and that secret, that dreadful secret that he'd been trying to keep hidden, his guilt is out in the open. And I wonder, I think verse 26 begins to show us something of the beginning of a change of heart. As in verse 26, Judah says, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. And later in the story, we're going to find Judah and all of the brothers coming before Joseph and being uncovered in their guilt. And saying, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. Well, there is the account. Now, what do we learn? Well, there are any number of lessons we can learn along the way, and I've tried to identify a couple of them for us. But there are two big lessons that come from God giving us this account of Judah, even as we think we should be thinking about Joseph. I don't know if you remember last week that I said that these stories can be told in two different ways. Either we can tell the whole story from start to finish on one evening, and then next week, or even on that evening, look at the two or three big lessons that there are in the whole story and then move on to something else in the Bible. The alternative is that we treat the story as I think it was meant to be treated. It was meant to be told and told again and retold. So that as we go through the story, like those family stories that we all have, we're meant to be kind of nudging ourselves. We know the end from the beginning. We know that Judah is going to find himself later in the story kneeling at the feet of his brother Joseph, uncovered. And here we are, right at the beginning of the story, being shown that great big theme as Judah's guilt is made plain for everybody to see. We know that Judah is going to be the man ultimately who God chooses out of all the brothers at the end of the whole story. Judah is going to be the one whom God chooses to be the one through whom he keeps his promises. Let's turn forward to chapter 49, shall we, and verse 8 to see that. Chapter 49, verse 8. This is right at the end of the whole story. And Jacob is blessing his sons, and it's a prophetic blessing. And he says to Judah, chapter 49, verse 8, your brothers shall praise you, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He stooped down, he crouched down as a lion, as a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So that ultimately, at the end of the whole story, we're going to find that God has a place for Judah in his family, even such a wicked man as this. Indeed, God is going to make Judah the one through whom he keeps his promises to be a blessing to the nations. And ultimately, all the nations will come to bow before one from Judah's line. And therefore, as we see God ensuring that Judah has got children, even through the most extraordinary means, we see God's absolute commitment to keep his promises, that he will provide a multitude of nations from this family, and that in this family all peoples will find blessing. Now, I think that leaves us with two major areas of application. One, these are the kind of people that God deals with. And two, God will certainly keep his promise. We cannot knock him off course, if you like. God will certainly keep his promise. These are the kind of people God deals with. God rescues a man who is totally disinterested in God and all his promises. God rescues a man who sells his brother into slavery. God rescues a man who is so bewitched by the world that he plunges himself wholly into the idolatry of the world. God rescues a man who visits a prostitute for a one-night stand. God rescues a man who commits incest. God rescues a man who proudly protects his public image whilst condemning his daughter-in-law to death. God rescues an out-and-out hypocrite who has lost all interest in God and his purposes. These are the kind of people that God deals with. Indeed, as we see the Bible story develop, we find that Perez, the child of Tamar through Judah, is the great-great-great-great-grandfather of great King David. And great King David is the ancestor of great King Jesus. So that if you go forward to Matthew chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, you will find that Tamar herself has a place in the family tree of Jesus Christ. And we can say, therefore, that in the family tree of God's people is a man like Judah. My elderly relative loved our family history, and you know what it's like. You always like to turn up some sort of famous, great one when you're doing your family history. And she always used to tell us about this general. In fact, she wrote a book about him. Well, imagine my surprise the other day when I was traveling somewhere on a train and reading the tyrannicide brief about the 17th century to discover this general's name, but painted in an altogether different light. For the somewhat plebeian general, unlettered, married to his cook, a good soldier with no political principle or philosophy, and so he went on. Well, I had no idea. I always thought he was a great hero. So I wrote to my aunt and asked him about this general who was in our family tree that we're told so much about. And she replied saying, yes, the plebeian general actually became an Essex man. I'm sorry if you're here from Essex. He was notorious then for his lack of table manners, taste and everything else. And he married the washerwoman, in fact, who looked after him when he was imprisoned in the Tower. Which was all rather a shock to me. If you belong to Jesus Christ, you have, if you like, deep at the foundation of our family history, Judah. A slave trading, prostitute visiting, backsliding, God denying, idolatrous, worldly, adulterous, incestuous, proud, hypocritical sinner. These are the kind of people who God is in the business of rescuing in Genesis 37 to 50. I think when we come across our own personal sin and failure, it can be enormously debilitating, and it can result in us doing what Judah did in chapter 38, verse 1. Drifting away from God's people and turning aside to the world. There are going to be times over the next 10, 20, 30, 60 years where you are confronted personally by the wretchedness of your own sin. I can assure you of it, if you're Christian. There are going to be times over the next 10, 30, 60 years, if Jesus doesn't return, where you're going to be confronted by the wretchedness of other people's sin. The staff tease me about saying this occasionally, but I think it's important that we're all open and clear about it. You know, there are things that I've done, both before I was a Christian and since, of which I am deeply, deeply ashamed, and which I haven't even, some of them, I haven't even told the people closest to me. And the staff always tease me about saying that I'm not going to tell you, but I'm not going to tell you, it's none of your business. But one of the things that our own capacity to sin does is debilitate. It prevents us being committed to God and to his people. It can cause us to distance ourselves from God's people and turn aside to the world. Indeed, it can act as a complete blockage on our own readiness to serve God. Can he possibly be of interested in me? Can I possibly be of use to him? Will he ever want me back? I've made such a horlicks of it. Well, one of the reasons I think we are given Judah, right here at the heart of the foundation of God's people, to be told to God's people as they make their way to his promised land, is to show us that God is in the business of rescuing people like that. It may, in fact, be that you're a Judah. You're finding yourself in Judah's position tonight. That you've drifted apart from God, and actually you've drifted apart from God's people, and indeed from God's promises, and really they're of very little interest to you at all, because you've become so sucked in by the world. And I don't know why you're here tonight, but you're visiting friends, or you're hoping to catch up with somebody, and perhaps you've drifted a long way away from God's people. And the presence of this incident of Judah makes it very plain to us that God is absolutely in the business of dealing with people like you. These are the people with whom God loves to deal. This is the promise that God is determined to keep. He's not going to let us stop him, you see. We're not going to be able to get in the way of his keeping his promise to produce a people from every nation and to produce a king through whom all peoples will be blessed. You and I, we're not going to be able to stop him doing that. He is going to do it. Come what may, he will achieve his purposes. We've seen this again and again in Genesis, over and again through the incidents and stories of Abraham's life and Isaac's life, and now in the account of Jacob. God will do it. He will produce his promised king. And he will produce his people taken from every nation and every tribe and language and tongue. He will multiply his people across the world. And you will not be able to stop it. And to put that principle back through the grid of Judah, which is, I'm sure, is what we should do as we come to apply it, we have to say, as we go on the next 10, 20, 30, 60 years, we will be tempted over and again to turn aside from God's people and to turn aside from God's promises and to go away and immerse ourselves in the world. And knowing that God is determined to keep his promises, it seems to me, is the most tremendous incentive to us not to do that. To stick with God, to stick with his people, to stick with his promises, and not to turn aside. I know the kind of things that are used to tempt me to drift away from God's people and God's promises. I wonder if you know the kind of things that will be used to tempt you to drift away from God's people. I wonder if you've thought about it. It may be the temptation of a pagan wife or girlfriend, as it seemed to be for Judah. It may be the company of pagan Adullamites, their social scene, so much more exciting than an evening Bible study or coming back to London to be amongst God's people and consider God's promises. It may be the sheer hassle and hardship of sticking with God and his promises. If we're going to take place in and part in God's plan and purposes to bring together a people, it will involve hassle and hardship and inconvenience to us. And it may well be that that becomes a temptation to drift away from God and his people and promises. It may be the cost of learning to love people who are very different to me. Or it may just be the pull of the idolatry of our age. Oh, you won't be asked to sleep with a cult prostitute. I don't expect the materialist of the city encourage us to do that. But they do encourage us to sell our soul to materialism and so be dragged away from God's people and God's purposes as we chase the career and the salary and the possessions. These are the kind of people God rescues. God will not be shifted from his promise. Let's pray together. Our Father, we praise you that you do abound in steadfast love and mercy, and that you have purposes even for a man like Judah. And so we pray that you would draw each one of us back and protect us and guard us with this glorious message of your grace and your mercy. We praise you for your promise, finding its fulfillment in Judah's offspring, the Lord Jesus Christ. We praise you that as we come to him, we find full forgiveness. And we ask, Lord, that you would use this warning of Judah and your dealings with him to keep us close to Jesus and close to Jesus' people. And we ask it for your name's sake. Amen.